Hi everybody, this is Tim Cross and this is my first attempt at doing a bit of a podcast. I thought I'd start off by talking about some of my life and career and hobbies and the rest, make a contribution like some of the other excellent contributions that others have made recently. In the future, I'm hoping to make some other podcasts, in particular dealing with Linux, because that's a platform that I use a lot. In fact, I probably use it more than anything else. So I thought I might do a few podcasts on using Linux, some of the tools that are available, such as Emacs Speak, Speech Dispatcher, and SpeakUp, and some of the other facilities that are available under Linux for people with vision and blind issues. And perhaps give a few examples of how you can use Linux in this way. So I'll be looking at that over the next few weeks and trying to come up with some nice, interesting podcasts. To start with, though, thought I'd just talk a bit about me. I live in Armidale, New South Wales, Australia. Armidale is roughly halfway between Sydney, New South Wales, and Brisbane, Queensland. Sydney being the capital of New South Wales and Australia's largest city. Brisbane being the capital of Queensland. It's on the eastern side of Australia. I'm about 2 hours' drive away from the coast. And as I said, roughly halfway between Brisbane and Sydney. Armidale's situated in what's called the New England, and it's on what's known as the Northern Tablelands, which means we're up fairly high. So Armidale gets quite chilly in winter. We usually get some snow at least once a year, but it's not enough snow to be of any fun. It just makes everything all muddy and yucky, essentially, and it's cold. It's never enough snow to go skiing or anything like that, and usually the snow only hangs around for a day or so, if even that. I mean, this year we got snow and rain at the same time, so really we just got mud, and none of the beautiful white cleanliness that you often sort of feel when something's got a good, decent amount of snow. The main industry for Armidale is sheep and cattle and education. Armidale has the University of New England, which is where I currently work, which is a very well-established university, probably has around 20,000 students all up, though the majority of them these days are external, and it's certainly had a fairly good reputation. It's not a bad place to work. Though the way government funding is going towards education at the moment, it's been pretty tough, but maybe I'll talk about that later. I grew up in this area. Initially, my parents had a property where we did sheep and cattle, and then later a little bit of tin mining. I've always had some vision impairment. This was initially due to rubella. When I was born, I had very little sight in my left eye, essentially just a light and dark perception, and what they estimated to be between 10 and 15% sight in my right eye. I didn't require much in the way of assistance. I didn't use a cane and was able to read just using glasses, though with some prints such as newspapers and phone books, I found that very hard to read and would sometimes have to use a magnifying glass. Or when I read a newspaper, would often end up with a rather black tip on my nose, because I'd be reading it so close I'd rub my nose on the newsprint. Things have changed somewhat since then, and I'll talk about that a little later. My initial schooling was in a regular school, a very small school. I think it was a total of 30 students, and it went from kindergarten to year six. And in a couple of years, I was actually the only person in my whole class, which was quite good. If I didn't do my homework, then it meant the whole class didn't do their homework. It was a one-teacher school, and yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I think I had a very good sort of life up until I was 12, living on a property. I was very, very lucky to have parents who insisted that I be treated the same as everybody else. I wasn't given any special privileges because of my disability, and in fact was made to do a lot of things to ensure that I had as close an experience growing up as children without disability. In fact, I was the youngest person to ever attend Pony Club, regardless of having a disability or not. I think I was about four. I actually don't remember it. As far back as I can remember, I was riding horses. When I was about nine, I actually had motorbikes and actually used to drive an old Rover car as well. I used to bang into the odd fence and a few other things. But, you know, I got to do all the things that kids growing up on the land tend to get to do. I used to even go hunting rabbits. I don't think I ever managed to actually hit any, but I used to be involved with it and all that sort of thing. My dad had this wonderful expression. He used to say that he wasn't going to bring up a white crow, which essentially meant that he wasn't going to treat me any differently and was going to make sure nobody else treated me any differently because of my disability. And I think this was a positive thing. Maybe as a few times as a kid I wasn't too impressed, but in the long run I think it really was the best approach to take. When I was about 12, they thought it might be worth sending me to a special school because that tended to be the expert opinion at the time. I was born in 1961, so at that time they actually thought that people with disabilities needed to be in special schools where they could receive additional assistance, and that tended to be the trend. So I was sent off to boarding school in Sydney at a school called St. Edmunds School for the Partially Sighted and Blind when I was 12. I only stayed there a year. I really disliked it, partially because I didn't like being away from home and I didn't like boarding school. But the main thing I disliked about it was that the attitude they tended to have was overly protective of the students. I didn't feel that we were treated the same as I was treated when I was at the regular school. We were, in a way, placed in cotton wool and protected. There was also, I thought, a low expectation of what we would achieve in our life. We were encouraged to aim for very low-level jobs and not encouraged to try and reach our full potential. And even at 12, I found this quite frustrating. So I only stayed there for a year, and I moved back home at the end of my sixth year at school. And at that stage, we left our property and moved into town where my parents opened a couple of shops, and I started attending a regular school in Armidale. Unfortunately, when I was 14, my dad contracted pancreatic cancer and died, and I stayed at home for another couple of years, but for economic reasons, I ended up going back to the boarding school in Sydney, back to St. Edmunds. This was because the way government funding worked at that time, it was actually cheaper for me to go to boarding school in Sydney than to stay at school in Armidale, because we would receive a whole heap of isolated children's allowance and other government funding if I went to the school in Sydney. So I decided to do this to help out the family a little bit, make life a little bit easier. So my year 10, I moved to Sydney. The way that St. Edmunds was structured, they actually only taught up to year 10. This was more of this attitude of not expecting people with a vision impairment to do particularly well career-wise, and there was this assumption that you wouldn't need to go past year 10 at school. Those who did want to go past year 10 actually boarded at St. Edmunds, but went to a regular school each day for their actual education. So I boarded at the school, and I went to a regular school called St. Leo's in Warunga each day, and I actually had a pretty good time down there. Going to Sydney at the age of 16 was quite good timing. It was, you know, that sort of age where I was getting interested in music and you know, going out and partying and having fun. And so moving from a quiet country town to a big city was certainly a positive thing for me. And I tell you what, I had a great time. I got up to all sorts of mischief, probably did a lot of things I shouldn't have done, was very, very lucky. I survived it not because I was careful and clever. I survived it all because of good luck, essentially. I did get into a fair bit of trouble at St. Edmunds. One of the things that I really didn't like was the fact that a lot of the kids that were my age, 17 and even 18, weren't getting the same life experiences that kids at regular schools were getting. And I remember once getting into a lot of trouble when I thought I would take a lot of my friends from St. Edmunds off to the pub to see a band. Most of us were 17 to 18 years old, and in Australia at any rate, nearly every boy at some stage when he's close to 18 will go to a pub. Although we're not meant to go into pubs until we're 18, we all do it, at least a couple of times, go into a pub as an underage drinker and have a few beers and play at being a growing up and enjoying ourselves. And I think it's important to have these experiences. I also think it's important for kids to be exposed to these sort of experiences as they're growing up. I've seen a lot of problems, particularly when I went to university, with kids that have been very protected by their parents. Suddenly they come to university, the parents aren't there, and they discover things like drinking and partying, and they overdo it. There's no self-control there, and they can really get themselves into trouble. So I think it's good for kids to experience a lot of that sort of stuff gradually as they're growing up. And my parents were very good at that. I mean, you know, probably from the age of 11 or 12, for example, if we had our Sunday lunch, you know, I would get half a glass of wine to have with the meal along with everybody else. So, you know, I was introduced to things like that, you know, gradually as I grew up. So it was no big deal for me. Anyway, I took all these kids off to the pub to see a band called Mental as Anything, and we had a hoot of a time. We really enjoyed ourselves. Probably had a little bit too many beers and got a little bit drunk. And one of my fondest memories is returning from the pub, getting off the railway station and walking from the railway station back to the school, and there was about 10 of us, and we're all hanging onto each other's elbows with me leading at the front. And I remember looking back over my shoulder, and there was just this long, wobbly snake of people following me along, all being very loud and singing and staggering slightly from being a little bit tipsy. And it was very funny. And of course, we got caught when we got back into the school, and I got into big trouble, and they threatened to kick me out and all the rest of it. But it all passed eventually. When I finished school, I started working in a number of different jobs. At one stage, I worked as a plasterer's assistant, and it was my job to go into old houses that were going to have all their plaster replaced and remove all the old lime-based plaster that used to be there. A very grotty, back-breaking job, and I hated it, and I only lasted at it for probably about 6 months or so. I then got a job putting in irrigation systems, which I thought was going to be fun, but of course I soon realised the only people that need irrigation systems are people that live in hot, dry climates, and spending your days outside in a big paddock under the blazing sun digging trenches and laying pipes and all that sort of thing didn't suit me very much either, and I soon got sick of that. I then decided to go to uni and see what that was like. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and everyone had told me that, you know, a nice secure career would be to become an accountant. So I started off doing an accounting degree, and I did a couple of years of accountancy. But to be quite honest, it bored me to tears. I really just couldn't stand it. The clincher came when I was basically not studying. I was going out and partying and having a good time. And then it came to the end of the semester and the exams, and I'd pretty much done no studying at all, very little reading from the textbooks. And I did the exam, and I got sort of distinctions and high distinctions for everything. And I realised, well, if I can do this without having studied for it, then what's the point of doing the course? So I dropped out, and I moved back down to Sydney, and got a job at the Royal Blind Society. I had developed an interest in recording and broadcasting. I'd been working at a small community radio station, and I sort of really got interested in that whole area of sound recording and broadcasting. So I went to Sydney, got a job at the Royal Blind Society working in the Talking Book Studios, where I stayed for about a year. After a while, I found it wasn't very challenging, and I decided to leave for Sydney and come back to Armidale. I really do enjoy living in the country, and I was getting very tired of the city. So I came back to Armidale and enrolled in uni again, but at the same time I started participating in the student radio station, and then got the job of manager of the radio station, which I did for a couple of years, and that was a heck of a lot of fun. It wasn't well paid, and it was long hours, but it was great fun. So I did that for a couple of years, and then decided I really should get serious about a degree. So I re-enrolled in university and enrolled this time in a Bachelor of Social Science degree, which I did over the next 3 years, and graduated in 1988. During that time, I also obtained a job at a place called the Challenge Foundation, which provided support services for people with learning disabilities, basically what was termed at the time the developmentally disabled. I obtained a position as a social educator. This was in the mid-80s, and at this time in Australia, there was very much a move to deinstitutionalise people. So they thought that a lot of people that were in large, for a better word, mental institutions, could actually have a more fulfilling and rewarding life living in the community, and could actually achieve, you know, better self development doing so. So my job essentially was a lifestyle training position, if you like, teaching people how to cope living in society. You know, everything from cooking, cleaning, shopping, you know, managing your bank accounts, all that sort of thing. I soon got promoted in that job and became what was known as a cluster manager, which meant that I was responsible for three of these houses, which was part of what was called the Community Living Project. My job involved, you know, making sure that staff were rostered on, that training programs were being developed and followed, and that, you know, progress was occurring. Unfortunately, as the 80s rolled on, despite the government's saying that they really wanted to see this deinstitutionalisation process work, they began to cut back the funding rather severely. And in the late 80s, it became very, very difficult. There was just not enough funding to be able to staff the houses adequately. I remember one Sunday turning up for work, and one of my clients was trying to fix his bedside lamp. The lamp had blown a light bulb, and he figured that if he took out the light bulb and started poking around in the light socket with a fork, he'd be able to fix it. So you can imagine my reaction when I walked in and found him doing this, and sort of realizing that, you know, he came very close to electrocuting himself. And the fact that it was my responsibility to ensure the clients were in a safe environment, I felt very uncomfortable, because the funding wasn't providing enough staff to make sure that the environment was safe. So I felt I was between a rock and a hard place, and I realised that I was going to have to get out of this job. It was just not going to be a very pleasant place to work. It was going to become more and more frustrating to try and achieve a good outcome with less and less funding. And I just thought, no, there's got to be something better. During that time, I'd also begun to get a little bit bored, because I was no longer studying and I was looking for something to sort of give me new interest. And I started thinking about the computers. Now, I'd used a computer during my social science degree, just for writing essays and, you know, a bit of spreadsheet work and doing a bit of statistics. But I never really understood how a computer worked. And I often get frustrated if I'm using something and I don't understand how it works. I really prefer to have a good understanding of how something works, so that I can use it to its fullest potential. So I started sort of buying a few books on computers, and I started reading about them, and I thought, this stuff's pretty interesting. And I thought, and it makes sense, it's quite logical, I can really understand this stuff. So I started playing around with computers more and more, and I decided, well, why not go to uni and do a computing science degree? Let's see if I can do that. So I started checking this out at the university, and I found that the university and its regulations actually had this special exemption where if you could show that you'd been working in the industry for, you know, a few years, they would let you enroll at second year rather than first year. Now, I was very keen in trying to do this, particularly because I wanted to get through it as quickly as possible, but also because the government had changed their attitude towards education. And where previously university education had been essentially free, they were now beginning to charge for it again. Now, at this stage, in the early 90s, it was still really a nominal charge, and you didn't have to pay it straight away. You could defer payment until you'd been working for a few years, and it'd just be an additional tax that was put on your income, depending on how much you earned, sort of thing. Once you earned over $25,000 a year, for example, you'd begin to pay an extra levy to pay back the cost of your education. So I also wanted to limit the number of years I was at uni to reduce that cost as much as possible. So I went out to the university and saw the head of the computing science course and said basically, oh yes, I've been working in the industry for a few years. You should let me in at second year level, thinking I might be able to bluff my way through. I think he was onto my game because he said, well, if you've been working in the industry and you have so much experience, you'll be able to finish all the first year assignments by next Friday. And, you know, trying to keep the bluff happening. I said, yeah, not a problem. And he said, okay, here they are. See you next Friday. And I sort of walked out of his office thinking, oh dear, I've really shot myself in the foot now. What the hell am I going to do? So I got on the bus and went into town and went to a local bookshop and found a book on programming Pascal and a couple of other texts and went home and started reading about programming. I'd never written a program in my life. I had played around with basic programming a little bit back in the late 70s, but, you know, really didn't have any clue about programming. So I sat down and started working. Luckily, I had a couple of friends who were doing a computing science degree, so I sort of invited them around for dinner and a few drinks, and I sucked every bit of knowledge I could out of them. And I actually managed, with a lot of effort, to get all the assignments done within the time limit and handed them in. And the lecturer looked at them and said, yep, they were fine, they were good enough, I'd done well, I could enroll straight in second year. So I enrolled in second year computing science and found the first semester extremely difficult. One of the first courses I had to do was a course called parallel processing, which was all about parallel programming, where you're writing software that would utilize multiple CPUs, so hypercubes and all sorts of high-end type technology. And this was very difficult. It was also all done using the C programming language, of which I had no exposure at all. So I had a very steep learning curve. But I enjoyed it immensely, despite the amount of work I had to do and some of the frustrating time getting through it. I really did enjoy it. And so I powered through the course. And at the end, I got a Bachelor of Computing Science, and the faculty asked me if I'd be interested in doing honours. And I thought, well, why not? I was enjoying it. So I enrolled in honours and did a thesis in an area of artificial intelligence called automated planning. And I was lucky enough to get first-class honours, which also meant that I had a good chance of receiving a Commonwealth scholarship. So I applied for a scholarship to do a PhD, and I was lucky enough to get a full scholarship. So I then enrolled in a PhD in computing science and was started working on a thesis relating to what was known as autonomous agents, which were essentially, I suppose you could call them software-only robots. These were bits of software that could autonomously move around on the internet. So some of the things I was looking at was, you know, how a program could actually bundle itself up and then send itself to another computer and then start running again. And the idea being that, you know, instead of trying to grab information from remote systems and suck it all back to your system and have all that overhead of bandwidth, remembering, of course, we're talking mid-90s and connection speeds were a lot slower than they are now. But instead of having to go and suck all the information back to you and then process it locally, the idea was you could have software that actually knew about where to find certain resources out on the internet. The software would actually go to the remote site. It would then do some sort of processing, filtering of the data or analysis or developing a report, and then come back to your system and give you the data. So the amount of data you were moving around on the network would be greatly reduced. Now, there's a whole heap of other issues, of course, that came up. You know, security being a big one. But, you know, it was a really interesting topic. And it's interesting to note that now there's a lot of languages like Java actually have built-in support for what they call serialization of objects, which is all about being able to basically have a piece of software that can save its state, its current sort of running situation and all its variables, pack itself up, and move itself off to another computer and start executing from where it stopped. You know, I found it all very interesting. However, unfortunately, at the end of a second year of my PhD, I woke up one morning with a very, very sore left eye. I had a bit of a headache. It got worse during the day, you know, and that night it was very painful. And the next morning when I woke up, I had a black eye. And I thought, this is very odd. You know, it looked like somebody had just given me a good thump in the left eye. So I got up and I thought, oh, you know, being a bloke, I wasn't running off to the doctor. I thought, I'll go to the chemist and get something to fix this up. I'll be right. So I went into the chemist and I saw the chemist and said, look, do you think you can give me something for my eye? It's a little bit sore. And the chemist took one look at me and said, no, but I think you should go and see a specialist straight away. And I thought, oh, Okay, well, maybe this is something. I better go and see my ophthalmologist and see what he has to say. So I made an appointment and went in to see him. And first thing he did was an eye pressure test, and was shocked to find out that my eye pressure was over 58, which is extremely high. I mean, your eye pressure is normally something around 18 to 22. So 58 was way up there. And it turned out that I had developed glaucoma. And the pressure had been so bad for so long, it had killed the optic nerve. So I'd lost all sight in my left eye. Now, I never had much sight in my left eye, but I certainly had none now. It was extremely painful. The pressure was so bad that the front of my eye was continually rupturing and getting sort of similar to little blisters. So every time you blinked, it was painful. They spent the next 6 months trying to reduce the pressure in my left eye using, you know, different drugs and drops and all the rest of it. But at the end of 6 months, it was obvious that nothing was having any real effect, and the decision was made to have the eye removed. It was quite interesting because a lot of the doctors and nurses and everything were very, very concerned about what psychological impact this would have on me having an eye removed. Apparently, a lot of people go through a fair bit of trauma at the thought of having an eye removed. Personally, for me, it was like, yes, please do it, get it done now. And 2 days after the operation was, you know, fantastic, because it was the first time in over 6 months that I had no pain. And just to have get away from that pain was so good. I didn't care. I mean, the eye was not working. It didn't give me any benefit. It was just something painful in the left socket. So having it removed was just instant relief, pretty much. So I was very pleased about that. Unfortunately, though, that wasn't the end of it. A few more months on, one day I began to sort of have a bit of trouble with my right eye, and I wasn't quite sure what the problem was. And I went and saw my ophthalmologist, and he wasn't 100% certain either. He suspected I had a detached retina. However, one of the problems is that because my vision impairment was due to rubella, I pretty much break all the rules. In fact, the very technical medical term they use is massive congenital malformation, which basically means we don't know. I mean, as far as they're concerned, with the knowledge that they have about eyes and vision, they don't believe I should have ever been able to see anything at all. I've got very small pupils. I've got a thing called a colobomia, which means that the back of my eye didn't form correctly. I have astigma, which means my eye shakes quite a bit. And apparently my retina, unlike most people, where your retina is quite smooth, mine is a bit like corrugated iron. So given all of this, it was very difficult for them to know for certain whether I had a detachment or not, but they suspected that's what it was, and they decided they needed to operate. Unfortunately, again, because of my eye morphology, it was not possible to use the laser techniques that they tend to use these days to deal with detached retinas. I've been quite surprised to find out how common a detached retina is. And in fact, bungee jumping apparently is one of the most common causes of retinal detachment. It seems that your retina is actually only attached in about four places. It's a bit like a spot welding. It's not, the whole thing isn't attached. It just has a couple of little spots where it's attached, and it's very easy for that to become detached. So when they came to try to repair mine, what they had to do was remove all the gel out of my eye, use a freezing technique to try and reattach the retina, and then they filled my eye up with an artificial substance and a gas. I was then required to lie on my front for 3 weeks, the principle being that the gas would keep the retina pressed up against the back of my eye and hopefully help it to reattach. So it was very important that I lay on my front. And I tell you, spending 3 weeks lying on your front is not fun. It really is unpleasant. I found it hard to breathe, constant pins and needles in your elbow and your arms because you've got your hands up and bent and all the rest of it. Unfortunately, the operation, although it was partially successful, it did take most of my vision. I initially had about 12 months where I had no vision at all. It was completely black. And then it slowly began to clear a bit, and I began to get back some vision, a bit of light perception, and then some distorted colours. However, I now need to use a cane. I can no longer read text. I have, you know, a lot of good and bad, a lot of bad days where I can see pretty much nothing at all. I mean, on a very, very good day, I can stretch out my hand and I might be able to just see my fingers. Bad days, I can stretch out my hand and, you know, I'll be lucky if I can see my arm. So it's very variable. Was a major life change for me. I went through quite a lot of depression. Unfortunately, my partner of 10 years had trouble dealing with it, and that's something I might talk about sometime. When something like this happens, there tends to be quite a bit of support for the person who's been directly affected. So I had quite a lot of support from the Royal Blind Society and other bodies. But there's very, very little support for the partners of those who've been affected. And often the impact on them can be nearly as severe as the impact of the individual. It requires a major life change for them as well. And unfortunately, my partner found it all got too much. So our relationship sort of basically fell apart. I am pleased to say, though, that since then we've re-established an excellent friendship, and although we're no longer partners, I would have to say that she's probably my closest friend, and we see each other almost daily, and we get on really well, and you know, it's a very wonderful friendship which I value dearly. Anyway, it took me some time to sort of gain all my skills back, and one of the things that did worry me was, you know, was I going to be able to continue with my career in computing? One of the things that I find quite funny is, you know, people talk about a career and they tend to feel that, you know, the impression is, you know, a career is this worked out plan strategy that, you know, gets you to your point that you want to be at. You know, it's a deliberate thing. For me, career is more like careering down a hill out of control. I never really had a strategy. I never really had a clear idea where I was going or what I wanted to do. I fell into computing mainly through, you know, it was almost accidental. I started playing around with it, and when I did, I found it was something I really enjoyed, but I also found I had an aptitude for it. You know, I've actually never done anything easier than programming and working with computers. It's the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. So it seems I must have some sort of natural ability with it. So I was quite worried after the loss of my sight. I thought that'd be right. You know, I finally found what it is I love doing and want to do, and now my sight's gone and I won't be able to do it. Of course, it was mainly the depression talking, and I was being very negative. During the time, especially the first 12 months when I had no sight at all, you know, I really found it very difficult to deal with. Boredom was a major problem. I mean, you know, what do you do when you've still not really got the skills to do a lot? I mean, I hardly had any mobility skills, so I was dependent on other people for almost everything. You know, I was having to learn to cook again and dress myself again and select my clothes and, you know, maintain my house. And, you know, I was determined to live alone. I still live alone. I love living alone most of the time. But, you know, that did mean that I really had to gain these skills as quickly as possible. One of the things that actually, I think, saved me from just going completely around the bend was actually learning how to use my computer again. It gave me something to do, it gave me something to focus on, and although I found it extremely frustrating, it was something. You know, I wasn't just sitting there feeling sorry for myself, and it was so I think in many ways it's probably what managed to save me from going too crazy. So I got stuck into it. It was very difficult. One of the reasons was that I'm a Linux user, and there's not a lot of support there for people who are into Linux, especially, you know, this is about 9 years ago, and certainly not for people with a disability. You know, all the people that I talked to that worked in this area, you know, if it wasn't JAWS and it wasn't Windows, they didn't want to know about it. They couldn't help. Actually, it's probably a bit hard to say they didn't want to know about it. They really just didn't know about it, so they couldn't help. So I was pretty much on my own, with a lot of trial and error, I finally got there. I used a package called Emacs Speak, which I think is a fantastic bit of software, and I'll do a podcast talking about all of this stuff later. But anyway, I spent 12 months sort of gaining all my life skills back and getting on top of the computing again, and then was lucky enough to score a job with a startup ISP. Initially, I was sort of doing system administration and setting up their systems and configuring, you know, all their user accounts and their web servers and news and all the other services and just maintaining the system. Then, as the company developed, I moved into a position where I was writing their software to basically do their user accounting and billing and invoicing and management. So I wrote that for them using basically a web interface and Java. And then later, the company was purchased by a larger company, and I then moved on to developing their system, which was a Perl-based system. However, I didn't like working for the larger company. This was mainly due to the fact that I'd gone from a small company where we all knew each other and we all worked together, and it was all, you know, it was a great working environment. I predominantly worked from home, but, you know, it was a really good working environment with some great people. When they were bought out by the bigger company, it became far more bureaucratic. They didn't want me to work from home. They wanted me to work in the office. They also insisted that I wear a tie, which I found ridiculous because I worked in the back rooms. I didn't have anything to do with customers at all. I couldn't see the point of wearing a tie. When I challenged them on this, they said, "You're more professional if you wear a tie." And then, of course, I argued with them that, you know, professionalism wasn't about whether you wore a tie and had shiny shoes. It was about the way you conducted yourself and how you did the job. But you know, as far as they were concerned, if I didn't wear a tie, I wasn't a professional. I realized I wasn't going to be happy in such a bureaucracy, so I started looking around for a new job. I got offered quite a few jobs in Sydney, some of them on very high pay, but I really didn't want to move to the big city. I really like country life, and I also have quite a good support network in Armidale. I've got a lot of friends here and family, where if I went to Sydney, I was going to lose all my support network. Dealing with moving to a big city is difficult when you're used to country life, even if you've got vision. It's even harder if you haven't. I know lots of people who are blind live quite successfully in the city, but I really just thought the quality of life issues, you know, was there really the benefit in there? At any rate, I just kept looking, and eventually I got offered a job at the local university as a programmer, analyst programmer. The job they were offering was actually a fairly low level. It was quite a considerable pay cut, but I felt fairly confident that I'd be able to, you know, prove myself fairly quickly and get promoted, which I did. Within 2 years, I'd moved up three levels, and I'd gone from an entry programming level to a principal analyst programmer, and was really quite enjoying the job. A new position came up. They were forming a data centre, and they were looking for a manager for the data centre. And I thought, well, maybe I should give this a go and see what it's like. It was another promotion, and I thought, well, you know, better see what I can do and how far I can get, sort of attitude. So I applied for the data centre manager's job, and I got the job. It was a two-year position to start with, and that 2 years has recently come up, and now they want me to take the job on permanently. Unfortunately, I found I'm not that keen on management. I really miss the technology. Management's all about staff and budgets and strategic plans and operational plans and risk management. Very little about technology and no programming. And I really miss the technology and programming side of it. So at the moment, they're still wanting me to be the manager, and they're offering more and more incentive for me to take the job on permanently. And I'm sort of saying, well, I don't think so. I really just want to be a programmer again. Let me do what I'm good at, sort of thing. Because for me, it's not about the money or the status or anything like that. I figure I've got at least another 20 years of work life in front of me. And I'd rather be 20 years of doing something I enjoy, even if it's less pay, than 20 years of doing something I don't really enjoy at better pay. I basically work to live, not live to work. And the demands that they want at the management level are extreme. I found in the last 2 years I've been averaging about 55 to 60 hours of work a week, and it was just beginning to run me down. And to be quite honest, I don't think I could do that for 20 years. I think I would burn out after probably about five. Programming, on the other hand, I love doing. I'll do 60 hours of that without a problem, you know, because I enjoy it. It doesn't feel like work to me, so burnout's not an issue. Money is not a big deal for me. I own my own house. I've got myself fairly well established. I don't want for much, and I'd rather sort of be doing things I find interesting than spending my time sort of generating wealth for no apparent reason. I mean, we can't take it with us, and you know, life is incredibly short. I think it's better to enjoy it. So I've got to go back to work next week and tell them my final decision. I've been on leave for the last month, I think they're going to be a little bit disappointed, because I think my final decision will be no, I want to go back to being a programmer, because that's what I enjoy. I'd also like to be able to spend less time in paid work, and be able to have some free time to contribute in other ways. I mean, you know, perhaps you know, there's some things on Linux that I'd like to contribute to the Linux project. For example, I'd like to contribute to more to the Emacs Speak and the Speech Dispatcher projects. Perhaps help with additional tools to make it easier for blind and vision impaired people to use Linux as a platform. You know, make some sort of contribution is what I'd like to do. Now, in a management position, I just, you know, literally don't have time to do anything but my job, essentially. And I just don't think I can sustain that. So I'd rather have a job that's less demanding, that allowed me to indulge my other interests and hobbies, and maybe make a contribution back, which is something I think we all should try and do if possible. And part of the reason why I thought I'd also do a few podcasts and see if I can provide some information for people. So that's basically my situation. Just to give you an idea of what the job as data center manager involves, there's about 15 staff that I'm responsible for. And the data center basically is responsible for providing the IT infrastructure for the university. There's about 20,000 users, and the data center maintains all the big databases, mainly Oracle, all the Unix and Linux servers, Windows servers, network infrastructure, and the communications infrastructure, which includes voice and the PABX and all that sort of thing. It's a fairly demanding job, particularly with the way government funding is going in this country at the moment. There is a very strong move to try and force universities into being more self-funded. Traditionally in this country, universities have been funded mainly by government funding. The government is trying to reduce its funding obligations on all fronts. I don't necessarily agree. I think one of the things that governments should always do is provide good health and education services at a low or no cost to people. I just think those are something that, you know, we really should do, and they're services that really should be available regardless of your economic situation. However, they're now going into... there's a whole heap of other reasons why I don't like a competitive education sector as well. You know, it's things such as research. You know, what sort of impact will it have if all our funding comes from industry and the only research that industry is interested in is research that will generate income for their companies or industry? What happens to all that research which doesn't seem to have any economic benefit? You know, it seems to be mainly theoretical. I mean, a lot of times that sort of research starts off theoretical. No one can see any specific application for it. But then, you know, later on it's realized that it does have a specific application. But if your funding is determined by industry and industry really wants to get something back, they're not doing this for any great social benefit. I mean, they're funding research hoping that it's going to give them some sort of competitive edge in industry. So they want to see research done that's going to benefit them economically. And I think that's a real concern. I think we're going to lose a lot of valuable research. And our research will be directed towards economic benefits rather than broader social or humanitarian or whatever benefits. I have a big concern about the way our society is becoming more and more economically driven. It's all about making money and profits. You know, the way that so many government institutions that have been sold off and becoming private institutions or companies with shareholders, and the only real concern these companies have is to their shareholders and making sure that share prices are highest and dividends are as high as possible. I really find that a short-sighted way of looking at the world. I think we need to start looking at things other than the economic. Profit's only a part of the story. There's other just as important things, environmental factors, social factors, things like, we shouldn't concentrate on gross domestic product as being the sole measure of how well our society is doing. I mean, that's a purely economic, financial-based measure. It doesn't take into account things like what we're doing to our environment, what the work conditions are like for people, what are the hours of work, how secure are people's jobs. One of the things you're seeing at the moment, for example, in most developed countries is a move away from permanent work to casual work. People who only have casual jobs have a lot of problems with getting things like loans to purchase houses. There's a lot of kick on from this, and this doesn't seem to be factored into a lot of the planning and the government policy of the day. It gets to me a bit, but I'm probably just beginning to waffle about this sort of stuff and get right off track. As I think I mentioned earlier, I will hopefully do some more podcasts. I've been looking to some of the tools that are available on Linux for dealing with sound and speech and all the rest of it. There's some great stuff out there. I mean, I've just found, for example, I've been playing for the last few days with a program called Echo Sound, which is a text-based sound mixing application. It's actually been specifically written for use by blind users. So it doesn't have a horrible graphical interface. It's a totally text interface and allows you to do things like mix tracks together, add effects, delay, echo, panning, that sort of thing. Process files in different formats, use software synthesizers to add sounds and effects, and it seems like a very powerful program. So I'm going to play around with that for the next few weeks and eventually hopefully do a podcast to sort of show some of the things you can do. One of the things that I like about Linux, and one of the reasons I got really involved in it, was the cost side of it. Although I don't have a problem paying for software, when I started doing computing science, I realized that if I wanted to be able to experiment with a lot of different programming languages and different technology, if I had to pay for commercial software each time, it was just going to become prohibitive cost-wise. Using Linux allowed me to experiment with different languages and different technology for a very, very low cost. And I've sort of continued in that vein since losing my vision because, as we all know, adaptive technology can be extremely expensive. I mean, this is partially due to the limited market compared to other markets. I mean, the hours it takes to develop a good screen reader, you've then got to recoup that cost somehow, which means that, the software often becomes quite expensive. But under Emacs, under Linux, with packages like Emacs Speak or Linux Speak Up or Speech Dispatcher, all that development's been done by volunteers who, put in a lot of time themselves. So there's no need to recoup costs. And so in some ways it's a lot more accessible to many blind users because it's got a lower cost. There's a lot of good stuff about Linux. It's not for everybody. I sometimes like to compare it to the difference between using a manual car and an automatic. Some people really just want to use a car and get from A to B. They don't really want to know about how to use gears and changing gears and double shuffling and all that sort of stuff. They just want to get in, turn on the ignition, and then, put it in the drive and put their foot on the accelerator and the brake and, drive it. Other people really like to drive their car. They really enjoy getting into changing gears and using the gears, and getting that extra power that you can get from having that additional control. Linux is a bit like that. If you really like that extra bit of control, of that extra understanding and working at that sort of finer-grained level, then you'd probably really enjoy Linux. On the other hand, if you're someone who just wants to be able to access the web now and again, read your email, you're not really interested in the technology. It's a tool. You just want to use it as a tool. You don't want to know a lot about it. You don't want to have to get down to doing configurations in text-based files and having to read about software to understand it before you can configure it, all that sort of thing. Then Linux probably isn't for you. The real benefit, of course, with Linux is that the costs are so low. Once you've bought your hardware, for $20 you get the operating system and all the software, basically. And you can pretty much do anything with it. Anything you can do in Windows, you can usually find a solution under Linux. Sometimes the solution mightn't be as polished, but then again, because these days a polished solution tends to be one with a flashy graphical user interface, people with vision impairment often benefit from the less polished solution. We like a text-based solution. It's what works well with screen readers. Graphic solutions aren't great for us. So in some ways, there can be some real benefits of using Linux. But one of the problems is with Linux, it's not easy to get set up initially. You usually can't do it if you haven't got a sighted person to help you. There is some wonderful groups out there, and if anyone is interested in Linux, I'd really recommend seeing if you've got a Linux users group in your area and perhaps attending a few of those meetings. But anyway, I'll leave that until some later podcasts when I can talk about Linux in more detail and some of the applications and some of the benefits and all the rest of it. Anyway, if you'd like to give any feedback or ask any questions, my email address is tcross@rapttech.com.au. So feel free to drop me a line if you want to ask any questions, want some clarification, want to correct anything I've got incorrect, or just, whatever. I don't mind. One of the things I love about email is that you can read it or you can delete it and ignore it. It's totally down to when it suits you. It's one of the reasons I also really like these podcasts. The thing is, you can download the podcast and listen to it at your leisure at a time that suits you. Unlike traditional radio and other media where, if a show's at 7, you've either got to record it or you've got to listen to it right there and then. Podcasts, it's, far more down to our control. And I have to say, I really do like the less commercial approach and the lower level of regulation. To me, a lot of these podcasts seem more real. They're not polished sort of Hollywood-type presentations. They sort of come along with warts and all, and to me, it just seems more real. I prefer to hear that. I'd prefer to hear stuff that perhaps I don't even agree with. What some people might even consider offensive. I somehow like the fact that people can express that. One of my favourite quotes was Samuel Clemens's one, and I'll have to paraphrase it because I can't remember it exactly, but it was along the lines, I may not agree with what you say, but I'll defend to death your right to say it. And to me, that's very important. I get very worried lately with what's been happening with the fear that everyone has over terrorism and all the horrendous things that have happened in recent times, that along with that fear that there may be a loss in our freedom to express our opinions regardless of what our opinions are. It's a very delicate area and I probably shouldn't get into it, but I do have to say I do have a concern that it would be wrong if we ended up with a situation where people felt that they couldn't express their opinions because they might get harassed or otherwise disadvantaged by doing so. Anyway, that's probably enough for me. I hope this hasn't drawled on for too long. I hope my Australian accent isn't too difficult to understand or too irritating. I must admit, I've really quite enjoyed listening to all the different accents. Hopefully others are going to also contribute, because I really think it's quite important getting out this career stuff. As I mentioned earlier, Certainly back in the 60s and 70s when I was at school, the attitude very much was, you have a disability, the best you can hope for is a low-level type clerical position or a, you know, telephone operator or whatever. You know, we were... I've actually got... Actually, it's quite funny. I actually have my careers advice that was given to me at school, and I've actually had it framed and put on the wall. And it basically says, you know, that I was of moderate intelligence, you know, with an average IQ, and that the highest level I should aim for would be some sort of clerical training at a college of advanced education. I've actually had that framed, and I've now got it hanging on the wall next to my three university degrees. it's just, you know, something that I like to remind myself that, you know, you can achieve whatever it is you want if you really want to do it. It mightn't be easy, but you can do it. And that really what we should be doing is, regardless of anyone's disability, we should be encouraging them to go for maximum potential if that's what they want, and not discourage it or limit people's horizons. We need to let people try and reach their fullest potential and encourage that whenever we can. Anyway, that's enough from me. Hopefully I'll get some more stuff together, and hopefully this has been at least a little bit entertaining. Thanks. Bye.